Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this day of the release of the Mueller report with an assessment of the orchestrated attempt to cover up Donald Trump's complicity with the Russians and his obstruction of justice in plain sight, given that the Republican hack chosen to do the job, William Barr, has already tipped his hand, allowing Trump to claim exoneration. Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the bombing of Cambodia, joins us to discuss the narrow constraints Mueller has been operating under and the absurdly hollow, incessant claim by Trump of no collusion when there is no way that the GRU and the KGB and its successor agencies, the SVR and FSB, would leave their fingerprints on an operation to hurt Hillary Clinton and helped elect Donald Trump. While proving collusion, not to mention treason, is a very high bar, little wonder Mueller could not prove conspiracy against the United States by Trump and his associates, because that is not how a security state headed by a former KGB colonel operates. There were no clandestine meetings and no messages exchanged at dead drops. Rather, Trump was a trusted contact, in KGB parlance, who would do what they want without even knowing who is working for them. A perfect useful idiot who might well get away with the crime of the century. Then we will talk with one of the country's leading experts on national security, William Arkin, who is writing a book on how to end the era of perpetual war. He joins us to discuss his article on what is behind the arrest of Julian Assange, which both the Daily Beast and The Guardian refused to print. We'll discuss how the repeated failures of the vast American intelligence establishment to keep its own secrets secure is at the heart of the need to punish Assange. Although Bradley Manning was able to steal a huge trove of classified documents, then Edward Snowden stole 1,000 times more of even much more highly classified top secret documents, then Joshua Adam Schulte stole the CIA's Vault 7 trove of top secret hacking tools. Nobody blames the intelligence agencies, and they are rewarded by billions more of taxpayer dollars showered on them to fix their mistakes. This is not to say Assange and Snowden are blameless and that the Chinese and the Russians end up benefiting from our intelligence agencies' loss of control of their secrets. But on this day, when it is unlikely justice is being done by our Attorney General, we offer up a link at backgroundbriefing.org to a thread by the Yale historian Timothy Snyder of a timeline of the extraordinary number of documented connections between Trump and the Russians who have financed and promoted him to the highest office on the planet. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is a comparative history of the inner politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And here we are speaking today. I'm on tape because I have to go to New York. But this is, of course, today is the day that the Mueller report comes out. Or should we call it the Barr report? What do you think?
I think it should be called the Barr report. You know, the very first reality that has to be faced here is that you've got an Attorney General of the United States who is on his rather full dubious record, a sleazy partisan Washington lawyer. As the prosecutors who work for him would say, he has a long rap sheet on matters like this. He was, of course, George H.W. Bush's attorney general, and in that role played a very, very instrumental and decisive part in the ultimate cover-up of Iran-Contra and the thwarting of justice there. And even before that, in 1989, at the Office of Legal Counsel in Justice, was responsible for a rather notorious redaction, his first major redaction of its kind. On the opinion of the OLC about the decision to make it legal and constitutionally proper, which of course it was not, for the United States to seize persons, including foreign nationals, abroad without the knowledge or consent of the sovereign governments involved on their territory. That was in violation of a number of precedents, including most prominently the United Nations Charter. And he neglected to mention that small fact in his largely redacted version of the OLC report, which he gave to the Congress in 1989. The difference, Ian, between then and now, of course, is you had a much less aggressive, much more timid Congress in 89, much more reluctant to confront these issues. Now, of course, you have a vigorous House of Representatives who will subpoena the Mueller report and who will eventually, sooner I think rather than later, tell us what was redacted in what's coming out today on Thursday. So this is not an issue without precedent. That, of course, does not take away from the fact that many of the critics on the liberal and democratic side of this issue very much overstated their case, overstepped their bounds on the issue of collusion, as the president defined it, the narrow issue of conspiracy with the Trump campaign by Russian intelligence. That was never really the heart of the matter. This was the most effective and sophisticated, in many ways, sophisticated operation in the history of Russian intelligence, which has a long and rather glorious past to it. And the collusion, so-called collusion or conspiracy, with this group of defectives and mediocrities who composed the Trump campaign was probably one of the least important and certainly the least pursued of the whole operation. They had their man in Donald Trump. They had a very organized and very effective campaign for subverting and subventing the American electoral process with their cyber interference and intervention. They were influencing millions of American voters in ways that the voters were totally unaware. They were backing this man at every turn. And of course, there was this long history dating back to the 1980s of the compromise of Donald Trump financially by the Russian oligarchs and by a series of transactions, everything from Trump Soho to Trump Tower in Moscow to the windfall subsidies that came from Russian oligarchs in real estate transactions, all the collusion at Trump Tower, the gambling and all the rest, which compromised this man as no other figure in the history of American politics. The Russians here did something from their point of view which was quite historic. Unlike the Soviets, who tried in vain to find that sweet spot for the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, mirrored in the American Communist Party, tried to find some kind of electoral leverage and foothold, even in the dark depths of the Depression, were unable to do so. Russian intelligence here found a candidate who was expressive of and symbolic of the weakest points, the most vulnerable points in the American political process. And they made it work. They elected themselves a president, our boy, as he was referred to by significant members of the Duma and of the Putin government. And they certainly deserve, in the annals of intervention and covert operations or non-covert operations, much of it was very much in the open, they certainly deserve credit for that. But we're not going to find out about that in this in detail in this redacted Barr Mueller report.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. So for those on the right wing, on the Trumpsters who are denying the Russia involvement and those on the left with the Nation and the Glenn Greenwalds, etc. There's a very good timeline and compendium put together by Timothy Snyder, the historian at Yale, which we'll have on our website, backgroundbriefing.org, which on this day of the release of the Mueller report, I think is worth reading. It's very short, but very pungent and very much to the point, showing the extraordinary numbers of coincidences, shall we say, in this story. Why do you think, though, Roger, that we know what a hack Barr is? And one of the aspects of Barr that has gone unnoticed is that he's a zealous member of the Federalists and very close to Leonard Leo, and that might well be ultimately the motive here. I don't think these people care much about Trump, but they sure want to get their people on the court. They've got their long lists, and they're getting everybody they want, and Trump's allowing it to happen. He just rubber stamps it. He doesn't care. And Mitch McConnell is opening the sluices at the Senate. So that, to my mind, is the real motive of Barr's. But what's happening with Mueller? Why did he roll over for all this?
Well, we don't know the details of the Mueller investigation. I must say, it's somewhat softening the worst judgment. His mandate to begin with was extraordinarily narrow. It was confined to this issue of, as Trump himself defined it, collusion or conspiracy, requiring them to find something quite specific and legally prosecutable about the relationship between Russian interests, Russian intelligence, Russian agents of influence, and the Trump campaign specifically. That almost ruled out or certainly narrowed the larger issue of Trump's own compromise in his past. This was a buying of a candidate that went on for a long, long time. It was an investment, as we said before, that dates back to the 1980s. I think that Mueller was compromised in a sense by who and what he always was. This was not some kind of white knight. You know, we experienced the shock therapy of the Trump victory in 2016, and almost immediately, many of the rather murky characters who had survived the Bush years into Obama, people like Mueller and others, acquired a patina and a purity that they really did not possess. This is a rather conservative Republican prosecutor whose own record was dubious in terms of his 9/11 post 9/11 tenure as director of the FBI and as a prosecutor and U.S. attorney. But this all goes to the point you were really getting to, Ian, which is that it's extraordinarily every man for himself here. Who is using whom in this sequence is going to be a wonderfully fertile field for historians. Trump obviously is for Trump, always was and always will be. The Russians have their own purposes and interest here, and it's certainly well known and clear what Putin is trying to do to disrupt the Western alliance as he sees it, to restore something of the old glory again as he sees it. And you've got the Republican Party of the United States using both the Russians and Donald Trump rather shamelessly to achieve their own goals, their own political purposes of capturing the court to fend off this demographic and political disaster which awaits them in the next 20 or 30 years in American politics, and tolerating the most egregious violation of simple good taste as well as institutional and political norms in the American system. So it is it's a cast of characters without shame, without disgrace. It's an exercise in total political expedience, which I think will go down in history as one of the great moments in political chicanery. And it's hard to say here who is worse in the whole process. The Russians are doing what the Russians deem in their national interest. And this is a man in Putin who has been elected and will continue to be elected as long as he stacks that system in the way he does, although his days are numbered. And we must always remember that he's presiding over a paper tiger of an economy and an underlying political weakness which cannot be sustained. Will it be the Republican Party, which is trying to fight all the trends of history, both culturally and demographically, politically in America? I don't think so. I think they will hold out for a while. Will it be Donald Trump? He will pass from the scene, I think, mercifully, in a very short order after he's defeated in 2020. So this is an extraordinary period, but it's a bonfire of the vanities, to quote Tom Wolfe, in every way in American politics.
So at the end of the day, I can't believe somebody spent 22 months and all those resources and came up with nothing. All you have to do is read all of the books about Trump's background, which are out, done by very credible journalists like Seth Hettner of the AP, Craig Unger, and Greg Miller from the Washington Post, among others. It's just extraordinary how much on the record we know about how Trump has been corrupted.
Yes.
None of that, I think, is being dealt with in the report. His past, starting, as you mentioned, in 85, when these Russian gangsters who came over here on the Jackson-Vanik Amendment.
As you said, the Snyder timeline is devastating.
Yeah. The Snyder timeline is something, Yeah, I'd like to, again, urge our listeners to go to backgroundbriefing.org, and we'll have a link to it on our website today to get Tim Snyder's timeline. It really does tell the whole story. I don't know.
Tim Snyder, unlike the rest of the political or media culture, is not suffering from some kind of dementia here in terms of remembering the history of all of this. His Bloodlands and other books about the history of Eastern Europe and of the Soviet Union are quite extraordinarily good. I don't think that anything that's happening now is all that counterintuitive or unusual, given the nature of the players. Mueller has never really gone beyond the rather narrow and conservative mandate of his position as he interpreted it. And he was not given the charge to look in, to cross the red line, as the president would have put it, to look into Donald Trump's larger corruption and financial compromise by a foreign power or by anybody else, the collusion of American banks or the total corruption of the American financial system in fostering the rise of this pathological demagogue. But he instead kept, I think, very narrowly to the mandate of this conspiracy charge, which they were hoping to find rather exact evidence of. It's absolutely amazing. What an underestimation of the sophistication of Russian intelligence. Did they really expect cables? Did they really expect dead drops between Donald Trump and Putin and the Russian ambassador in Washington? It's as if they were looking for a replay of the green glass spy ring in Los Alamos. That's not the way these things work these days. It wasn't ever necessary with Donald Trump. Mueller was never going to find that. There may have been a great investment by MSNBC and by the Democratic Party and by others in that theory, but it was a very, very weak read. And yes, of course, there's been money laundering. Yes, of course, there's been this wider corruption in the Snyder timeline. Shows that very clearly, but that was never really within the purview of the Mueller investigation. And one more thing I should point out: the Democrats are now going to try to uncover this in subpoena power in the House of Representatives, and they have sort of little known kind of inside baseball thing here, but they have at their disposal a staff of former prosecutors and lawyers, expert in these fields, every bit as good as, perhaps in some respects better than, this very vaunted team of Mueller prosecutors that who got such wonderful publicity from the liberal press when they were hired. These are the guys who were going to save us from Donald Trump, all of which, as you know, Ian, was a very handy way of denying how much collusion and complicity the Democratic Party and the Hillary Clinton campaign and the media itself had had in Donald Trump's election. This was a disaster for the left in American politics, and I'm the left I use loosely here, disaster for the non-reactionary Democratic Party. And they found a ready excuse and a wonderful justification in the Mueller inquiry, but that was doomed to the kind of inconclusive and, in some respects, catastrophic end that it's come to.
Well, Roger Morris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. And his latest book is Kindred Rivals: America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why the U.S. intelligence community wants Assange. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is William Arkin, who is one of the country's leading experts on national security, who is writing a book on how to end the era of perpetual war. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Arkin.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, thanks, William. And you wrote a piece just after the arrest of Assange, which The Guardian and The Daily Beast turned down. But I find it, I'm glad you sent me a copy, and I find it really compelling. My sense is that everybody else is missing the story here. So what's your sense of where things are now a few days later?
Well, let's just review what happened. Julian Assange was kicked out of the Ecuadorian embassy, if you will. And that was really the result of a change in government in Ecuador and a lot of pressure on the part of the United States on the government. Then he was arrested by British police for an outstanding warrant relating to his jumping bail in 2012 when he was wanted on a Swedish rape case. And now he's incarcerated in a British prison, awaiting action on his jumping bail charge and extradition to the United States. The Home Office in Britain, that's the agency responsible for internal security, if you will, has stated that it's considering an extradition request from the United States. And on the day that Julian Assange was arrested, that is last Thursday, the United States, through the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Virginia, that's the district of the U.S. Attorney's Office that generally handles these national security cases, unsealed an indictment against Assange, which solely dealt with the question of assistance which he purportedly provided to Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, in 2010 in order to assist Manning to crack a password on a Army laptop computer, which would allow him to surf the secret network of the U.S. government without being identified. In other words, to a fake administrator privileges. So we sort of knew already from the Manning trial that that someone from WikiLeaks had helped Manning to do this. The person was never identified as Assange himself, and now the indictment is claiming that it's Assange. And so, again, we are innocent until proven guilty in this country. And it's a very narrow indictment. And I think that it's a very narrow indictment because the U.S. government wanted to make a charge against Assange that was believable and acceptable to the Ecuadorian and UK governments. And the fact that it reaches back to a case that's now 10 years old isn't really anything to do with Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning. It's not anything to do with the case of the Manning documents per se. It's just that they really needed a narrow charge to suit those two governments in order to take action. So the obvious question is, why now? Why is action being taken now? And the answer is, first, that the Ecuadorian government was amenable to kicking Assange out of the London embassy. But second, that in March 2017, and this is what I wrote in my blog, WikiLeaks released a whole series of documents of the CIA from the CIA Center for Cyber Intelligence that were essentially the hacking tools that the CIA used in its covert hacking campaigns. Now, this is separate from, say, the stuff that Edward Snowden had released on the NSA. It's separate from another set of documents which had been released in 2016 called the Shadow Brokers. This was a whole new set of documents from the Central Intelligence Agency, and it was a huge shock to the Central Intelligence Agency, which really had not seen a massive leak from inside its institution since Philip Agee in the 1960s, 70s. And so I think that the CIA really reacted in a panic in 2017. And if you remember, the CIA director at the time, Mike Pompeo, now the Secretary of State, made a speech in April 2017, which was very focused on WikiLeaks, calling it a hostile intelligence organization and really questioning whether it was a journalistic entity and calling it out for its soliciting of information, both from Manning, but also he made other claims in that speech that WikiLeaks had tried to place people within the CIA for the specific purpose of gaining access to classified documents. And so Pompeo made this speech in April of 2017. I don't think very many people paid attention to it. And if they did pay attention to it, they thought that Pompeo was talking about the role that WikiLeaks had played in the 2016 presidential campaign. But in fact, it was really a CIA-written speech which related to this breach of the CIA, which was unprecedented and which essentially declared that the U.S. government was going to shift the focus of its attention from seeing WikiLeaks as a journalistic entity to trying to make the case that WikiLeaks was, in fact, a quasi-intelligence service soliciting secrets from Americans. And that was the basis for Assange being kicked out of the embassy and being arrested and possibly will be the basis for his extradition if the British government agrees.
And again, I'm speaking with one of the country's leading experts on national security, William Arkin, who is writing a book on how to end the era of perpetual war. So we're on tape today, William, because I had to travel to New York on this day that the Mueller report is coming out, the biggest news day in many decades. So we can speculate what is in the report. But let's just finish up on Vault 7, because I think you're right on the money that I think they basically came up with some kind of pretext, and they wanted to avoid the reason they have these computer charges is they want to avoid any kind of First Amendment issues with Assange. And just a couple of days ago, the president of Ecuador, who's under pressure at home for what many of his critics say was the sellout of their sovereignty, he said, "We cannot allow our house, the house that opened its doors, to become a center for spying. This activity violates asylum conditions. Our decision is not arbitrary, but is based on international law." So that's how the Ecuadorians are covering themselves. But my understanding is that if the British do extradite Assange to the United States, and there's a possibility that he may even go to Sweden before then, that it would take a year or more. So is that your understanding, that we're talking about something that may or may not happen, but if it does, it will take a year at least before Assange shows up in an orange jumpsuit in American captivity?
I don't think it's going to happen anytime fast, Ian. And there's another element of the Assange case which is really important, which is we haven't really heard from the Australian government yet. After all, Julian Assange is an Australian national, and whether the United States even really has the authority to indict and try an Australian national for a violation of a U.S. domestic law is even questionable. Now, we have a lot of doctrine in which, you know, the international community has decided, as it started to do in the 1990s, that there were some violations of the law that applied across the boards, like humanitarian intervention issues. And so, and sanctions, which are brought against bad people. But it's not clear to me that Julian Assange will ever appear in an American courtroom. It's not clear to me that the U.S. government particularly has an interest in providing Assange with a megaphone to appear in an American courtroom, nor do they want to necessarily deal with that headache. So it still really is unclear whether or not Assange will even be extradited to the United States, let alone ever appear in a court. So the real question is then, what does the United States want? And really what it wants more than anything else is to deter the next leaker. It wants to shut down WikiLeaks because that is a conduit by which these leakers of massive amounts of documents have utilized an organization to disseminate their material. So more than anything else, the United States internally wants to stop the next Manning, the next Snowden, the next Joshua Schulte, who was responsible for the Vault 7 CIA documents. And secondarily, I think it wants to do irreparable harm to WikiLeaks, to destroy it as an organization so that it's not viable any longer to provide the platform for a large cache of secret documents to be disseminated. So I think those are the objectives. I think Julian Assange, frankly, at this point, as much as he is a celebrity around the world, is a bit player in what the United States really wants.
Well, you mentioned Australia. Assange's father is lobbying the Australian government and the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, who is actually put into office by Rupert Murdoch, who is the kingmaker in Australia. He controls most of the media. And he decided he didn't like the previous Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, and he's put in Scott Morrison, who is a born-again Christian with the same evangelical faith as Mike Pence. So I'm not sure. I think if you want to know what's going to happen to Assange vis-a-vis Australia, you have to find you have to talk to Rupert Murdoch. That would be my suggestion.
Maybe it's the case, Ian, but I still think it's important that these legal issues are going to be argued. And we don't know what the jurisdiction of the United States really is against a foreign national. So whether the Australians speak up or not, it's still going to be challenged in court. And Assange's primary attorney is an Australian barrister. And so I think that it's important for people to understand that this is not going to unfold anytime soon. And if, in fact, the Swedish government decides to renew the charges against Assange and he is then extradited first to Sweden, then it's really going to play out in slow motion. It's a kind of a conundrum, I think, from talking to my sources, people in the intelligence community and in law enforcement at the FBI level. I've heard two arguments. One is that the United States really just wants to shut down WikiLeaks and do damage to that organization. And two, that the United States really wanted to silence Assange. Now, they probably have achieved at least the latter goal, and they believe that they are doing better at stopping these so-called insider threats. But I think as the March 2017 leaks from the CIA showed, was that even after WikiLeaks had involved itself in the 2016 elections, even though WikiLeaks had provided a conduit for the Democratic Party and the Democratic campaign internal emails to be published, it was still an attractive place for a millennial who had been working in the CIA with a top secret clearance, who had stolen almost 100,000 documents to provide that material. So to a certain generation of people, WikiLeaks is still seen as a heroic organization doing a unique service. And I think that that's something that the U.S. government is not going to be easily able to reverse.
And let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation with William Arkin on this big news day with the release of the Mueller report. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we're continuing the conversation with William Arkin, who is one of the country's leading experts on national security, who is writing a book on how to end the era of perpetual war. So on this momentous news day, William Arkin, we're on tape. Of course, we don't know what the Mueller report is going to say. But in terms of Assange, surely the extent to which he helped elect Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton, surely that has tarnished his reputation amongst a lot of people around the world.
Well, first of all, let's just talk about the Mueller report. I don't think it's going to be, I'm sorry, I don't have the opinion that it's going to be much of a mystery what's in that report. We already know the parameters of what Robert Mueller has looked at by virtue of the indictments which have already been brought down by the Mueller investigation. And we have a fairly good sense as well of what it is that they have discovered. I don't think there's going to be much surprise on Thursday. But one surprise, if people have been watching this very closely and hoping that somehow there's some secret in the Mueller report, is that WikiLeaks really won't be addressed. That what this indictment last Thursday showed us was that the ongoing investigation and grand jury against WikiLeaks, which had been going back to 2010, is still impaneled and still working. And it's one of the reasons why we never saw an indictment of WikiLeaks as part of the Mueller investigation. I don't think we're going to see very much additional amplifying information. And here's why, Ian. because WikiLeaks is an organization which is operating today, because the FBI has an ongoing investigation into WikiLeaks, and the intelligence community is still collecting information about WikiLeaks' role and relationship with the Russian government and possibly even with the Chinese government. So as a part of an ongoing investigation, I can assure you that the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia probably said to Mueller, we have this already. You can't tread into this territory because this is an ongoing case. And in fact, from what I understand, from the people I've interviewed, from the documents which I've seen, and I followed the WikiLeaks case for now for more than a decade, is that the U.S. has a very strong and deep investigation into WikiLeaks, including confidential informants inside the organization. So none of that is going to come out in the Mueller report, whether it's in it or not. That's exactly the kind of material relating to sources and methods that will be redacted from the report before anything is made public. So I don't think we're going to really find out anything about WikiLeaks whatsoever. And in terms of the broader question of who gave what to who, that is, how did the emails move from Washington to Moscow and then move from Moscow to London, where they were then put on the internet and did influence the 2016 campaign? It's not really even the general or specific focus of the Mueller investigation. The Mueller investigation is about how people associated with the Trump campaign and the Trump administration might have themselves cooperated with Russia or might have themselves been involved in manipulating the 2016 campaign. So WikiLeaks, to some degree, is a sideline to that fundamental question of the Mueller investigation. And so I think that when people hear the news today, they should be careful to understand that the special counsel was given responsibility to look into the Trump administration and those involved in the Trump campaign. It wasn't a general fishing expedition about everything under the sun that had to do with Russia. And because Russia still exists, and because WikiLeaks still exists, and because there is still a vibrant battle, if you will, behind the scenes between the U.S. and Russian intelligence over this kind of cyber hacking and this kind of influence through social media, etc., I don't think we're going to really read very much about it today at all, because the truth of the matter is that this is something that is at the forefront of the confrontation between the United States and Russia, and indeed between Russia and much of Western Europe and the democracies around the world. So I don't think that we're going to have anything that's going to come out today that's really going to give us any kind of new insight into the Russian government's objectives or what U.S. intelligence knows about what Russia is up to.
Well, clearly from the Mueller court filings, we already know that U.S. intelligence knows an awful lot about the Internet Research Agency, where all those indictments came down. My understanding is that it was Dutch intelligence that somehow slaved the GRU camera inside the Internet Research Agency run by Prigozhin, the Putin chef, where a lot of the trolling apparently took place. So every time, as they passed through the metal detector, past the GRU booth, they had to show their face and show their ID, and that's how Mueller was able to get these details on who these people were working on this project against the United States, and a number of them have already been indicted. So it does seem that as we talk about WikiLeaks and Putin and all the successes they've had in terms of penetrating the U.S., there is also evidence on the other side that Western intelligence has been quite successful in penetrating what the Russians are up to.
Well, I think that you're basically right, but I also think that the Dutch story is sort of a great cover story that avoids the CIA or the NSA having to say anything about how good it is or isn't doing in terms of penetrating the Russian government by itself. So in the fall of 2016, I reported at NBC that U.S. intelligence was able to establish that Putin had given the direct command to start utilizing the material that the Russians had intercepted or hacked in trying to assist Donald Trump to get elected president. That came from a high-level human source inside the Russian government that was being run by the CIA. We know that for a fact. So you have to look at this whole investigation and the context of U.S. relations with Russia as also saying, you know, we're not just doing a retrospective recounting of what happened in 2016. This is the U.S. relationship and the U.S. confrontation with one of its primary adversaries and one of the most powerful nations on the planet because of its nuclear capacities. So the truth of the matter is that the United States government is not particularly interested in cutting off its own sources of intelligence. It's not particularly interested in revealing all of what it knows about what happened in the 2016 elections, not so much because it's hiding something, though we can talk about that in a minute, but more because this is an ongoing confrontation. This is an ongoing relationship. And though the news media might be completely focused on the question of whether Donald Trump's campaign people and whether people hanging around the externals of the Donald Trump campaign, like Roger Stone, were colluding with the Russians or might have been trying to collude with the Russians. The truth of the matter is that's not where the U.S. government is in 2019. The U.S. government has moved on. So here's the question, Ian. What is the U.S. government still not wanting to say? Well, I think, and this gets back to Assange as well, is that the U.S. government really is not accountable for its failure in 2016. So let's just think about what we're talking about in a bigger sense. If indeed you believe that Russia had an influence in the outcome of the 2016 election, and if you believe that the CIA and the FBI were privy to any information which might have proven that Russia was trying to have an influence over the outcome of the election, the first question I would ask would be, did we do enough? Did the United States government do enough to inform the electorate of that fact and to stop the Russians from doing what they were doing? And I think the answer I would have to come to today is still no, they didn't. And if the FBI had confidential informants inside WikiLeaks, if the FBI, as we now know, and it will come out in the subsequent weeks and months of the Assange investigation, had intercepted WikiLeaks' emails, had confiscated cell phones and laptops from WikiLeaks people all over the world, had collected enormous amounts of information, how was it possible that the FBI also at the same time failed to see the cooperation between WikiLeaks and the Russians in 2016? How is it possible that they missed that? And so really what I'm concerned about more than anything else, because Donald Trump will go at some point, if not in 2020, eventually he will fade into the history books. The truth of the matter is that the U.S. government has not been really held accountable. It's not been held accountable for the fact that Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, that Edward Snowden, that Joshua Schulte, all people who had been conferred top secret clearances by the U.S. government, leaked these enormous amounts of information. Where's anyone who has been held accountable for those leaks, for the failure of that security system? Where's anyone in the FBI who's been held accountable for failing to see the WikiLeaks connection to the Russians in 2016? Where's anyone from the Obama administration who's willing to stand up and take responsibility for the fact that their sluggishness and their fecklessness might have actually resulted in changing the outcome of the election? Those, to me, the accountability of the American government is the real story that we should be focusing on. And I'm afraid that we don't get to that story because people are so obsessed with Donald Trump that they can't even take a breath to think about what is it that is really important here.
Right, and I think, you know, to some extent, reality winner is probably a sacrificial lamb in that regard, because she was actually trying to alert the public about stuff that the NSA was sitting on. But if you go through that list with Schulte leaking Vault 7, which WikiLeaks published, and which may well be the reason for the U.S. going after Assange, as you made clear, and then Snowden, and earlier than that, Bradley Manning, or now Chelsea Manning. One of the things that's extraordinary about Snowden is, my understanding is in 2008, when he was an IT guy for the CIA working in Geneva, he tried to break into the computers of the operations division, the director of operations, which is the crown jewels, and for some reason or other, that never went on his file, and then he applied for a job at Booz Allen Hamilton, got the job, and was able to download all of this stuff. According to the House Intelligence Chair, now Chair Adam Schiff, 95% of what Snowden took had nothing to do with civil liberties. He then, just as the NSA instituted a program that looked for big downloads of data, and they put it in all their stations around the world. The last station to get it apparently was Hawaii, and just before that was installed, that's when Snowden skipped town, and he goes to Hong Kong, and the first thing that's released was a finding signed by President Obama about Chinese cyber activity, where the U.S. was going to counter with its own cyber offensive against China. That was leaked on the eve of Xi Jinping's first visit to the United States to meet with Obama out here in Palm Springs. So Obama ended up with egg on his face. So there seems to be some strategy there. So what's your sense of whether or not, I mean, people get so partisan about these issues, it's possible to have two thoughts in your head at the same time, that Edward Snowden could be both a hero and a traitor. Where do you come down on that, William Arkin?
Well, let's talk about all of the people we've been discussing today. I mean, from Julian Assange all the way through to Joshua Schulte, the leaker of the Vault 7 documents from the CIA, the purported leaker. He still has not been found guilty in a court of law. So on all of these people, you know, these are people who are, I guess we should say, practicing civil disobedience. Now, they're obviously willing to go to jail for what they did. I can't imagine that Julian Assange or Chelsea Manning or Edward Snowden or Joshua Schulte thinks that they should just walk away scot-free. You know, people who have practiced civil disobedience throughout American history, they have been willing to risk being incarcerated in order to pursue what it was that they believed. So first and foremost, I would like to see them as people who are practicing civil disobedience. Now, you may hate them, or you may think that they are self-aggrandizing egotists. You may think that they are naive in terms of what power they might have in their leaking of this material. But more than anything else, it's important that we see that they, in their own heads, were doing something that they thought was going to strengthen the United States or make a point as to what it was that they thought was an injustice that needed to be repaired. So that's really what I think of all of these individuals, from Assange to Schulte. I don't really see them any different. They think that they are, in fact, doing God's work. And whether they have broken the law or not, well, that will be decided in a court of law. And we'll see whether or not they will be held accountable. Manning already was. A 35-year sentence as a result of a military court-martial, and then that sentence was made shorter by President Obama on the eve of his leaving, where he didn't pardon Chelsea Manning, but said that the 7 years that Chelsea Manning had served was sufficient. And I think that was done on the basis of the fact that other large-scale leakers of the Manning type had never gotten a 35-year sentence, and so it was really justice done by Obama. In the case of Snowden, if he ever leaves Russia, he's going to be arrested, and he will be held accountable in a court of law. Joshua Schulte, who was arrested last year, is now sitting in the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York awaiting trial. And Julian Assange is now sitting in a jailhouse in Britain, and we'll see what happens to him. So in each of these cases, I think it's important for us to first not say whether or not they are guilty or not, because they haven't been found guilty in a court of law. But second, to also see what they did as both an act of civil disobedience, and then secondly, to see it whether it did or did not damage the United States. Frankly, I can't really tell you, Ian, today in April of 2019, that I think that anything that Manning did, or anything that Assange has done, or anything that Snowden or Schulte has done, quote, damage the United States. Did it complicate the operations of the U.S. intelligence community or U.S. foreign policy establishment? Absolutely. But really, to prove damage, like to go back 10 years now and think about what Chelsea Manning did in 2010 as to whether or not it really damaged the war effort in Afghanistan or Iraq, I don't think so. But there were damages done, damages to U.S. intelligence agents, damages to the workings of the government, damages to the sanctity of the security system. So it's like also being held accountable for a violation of the law. But in national security terms, it's still unclear whether or not they actually had any real deleterious effect. Now, the U.S. government would argue, and again, this is why I say we need to wait for the courts to decide. The U.S. government would argue that Snowden and Schulte had an enormous effect, and they operate as if every document that Snowden and Schulte stole ended up in the files of the KGB and Chinese intelligence. That's how they act. They act that way because they have to take the countermeasures to ensure that whatever programs they operate that might have been compromised, indeed, that those programs are protected. But it's not clear necessarily that happened. Certainly hasn't been established in a court of law. And so right now, I think what's interesting is that if you talk to people inside the U.S. intelligence community, what they're really worried about is the next Joshua Schulte, the next Edward Snowden, the next person who is going to take 100,000, 10,000, 1.7 million, as was the case in Snowden, documents, and steal them from inside this secure firewalls of the U.S. government and publish them or give them away. And they spend $10 billion plus on internal and physical and classification security within the U.S. government, $10 billion plus a year. And that system doesn't seem to be convincing enough to these young workers who get these top secret clearances, who get access to all of this material. And so we are in this conundrum where, on the one hand, we want to have the U.S. intelligence community collecting good intelligence, and we want them to share it with each other so we can avoid another 9/11. And on the other hand, because that information circulates so freely amongst so many people, they are also running the risk of the damages that might be caused if somebody steals so many documents. So if you ask me, and I would say the real issue is that we have way too many secrets, way too many people with access to those way too many secrets, and we don't have accountability for the system that creates all of those secrets. To me, in the long run, those are the real threats to the United States' national security.
Well, William Harkin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me on, Ian.
And I've been speaking with one of the country's leading experts on national security, William Harkin, who is writing a book on how to end the era of perpetual war. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.